content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article today, a new group of Buddhist technologists is working to shape the future of AI. This was written by Hayden Royster. When Chris Scammell arrived in London in 2022 to work at an artificial intelligence safety startup, Conjecture, he moved into a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in the heart of the city. It was an apt home base for Scammell. His spiritual practice had evolved alongside his mounting fears about AI. Back in 2021, Scammell worked at a hedge fund in Manhattan and lived with friends, two machine learning engineers who became prominent voices in AI research. That winter, under the alias Janus, the trio began drafting simulators, an early critique of large language models that made waves in Silicon Valley and beyond. In the spring of 2022, the engineers joined the founding team of Conjecture, and Scammell was invited abroad. Scammell was deeply concerned by AI's breakneck development, he said, especially considering that relative nobodies like him and his friends had a lot to contribute to AI safety in a short amount of time. Still, he found some harmony between the technology and his Buddhist faith, which had blossomed after a college program in Bodh Gaya, India. With vast oversimplification, some Buddhist schools believe we as entities are instantiated from a larger pool of consciousness, he said. That, metaphorically, is what a large language model is. Now, after 3 years at Conjecture, most recently serving as chief operating officer, Scammell is pouring himself into a new venture, the Buddhism and AI Initiative. Launched publicly in August, the project aims to bring together Buddhist practitioners, technologists, and researchers to shape the future of AI. In an announcement on web forums Less Wrong and Effective Altruism, Scammell described their initiative as an attempt to get Buddhism as a stakeholder group up to speed on AI. He laid out domains of potential impact, including AI governance and policy, and awakening and alignment tech. In addition to Scammell, the organization's core team includes Alex Sakarasian, a startup founder turned Buddhist chaplain; Ryan Stagg, a former digital strategist for the Dalai Lama's Mind and Life Institute; Austin Pick, a longtime administrator at Naropa University, a Buddhist college in Boulder, Colorado; and Peter D. Hershock, an adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center and author of the 2021 book Buddhism and Intelligent Technology. Scammell first connected with Hershock through the Future of Life Institute, the nonprofit behind a recent open letter condemning the pursuit of artificial superintelligence, with signatures including Prince Harry and so-called AI godfather Geoffrey Hinton. The Institute also provided initial funding for the Buddhism and AI initiative. Since the early days of the Internet, Hershock has written about Buddhist philosophy and technology's colonization of consciousness, as he calls it. In 2018, during a research trip to China, he encountered the country's nascent AI systems and was blown away, he said. I thought, what will the attention economy look like if it gets supercharged by AI? Now, Hershock believes, we're living in that world. A guest speaker at the Dalai Lama's recent summit on AI, consciousness, and ethics, Hershock is especially concerned about alignment, the process of ensuring AI systems act in accordance with human interests and values. From a Buddhist perspective, aligning with human interests is the worst thing possible, he said. Look at Gaza, Ukraine, domestic violence, global hunger, climate disruption. We've got some work to do first before we align our AI systems with us. In time, the Buddhism and AI Institute intends to fund projects that infuse Buddhist wisdom into AI development and deployment. At this early stage, though, they are mapping the ways Buddhism and AI are already informing each other. For instance, some Buddhist organizations are exploring how AI can aid meditation, education, and translation. Seeking to translate all 230,000 pages of the Tibetan Buddhist canon into English, the nonprofit 84,000 is leaning into machine translation tools, which can and do help achieve the best possible quality of the emerging translation, said Thomas Doctor, 8400's AI strategic consultant. However, others point to limitations. Jui Shi, director of the Humanistic Buddhism Center at the Nantian Institute, a Buddhist graduate school in Australia, began her career developing AI for Singapore's government before taking vows as a Fo Gong Shan Buddhist nun. She said she is impressed by the speed of AI translation and generation, but finds its spiritual and historical accuracy lacking. It just takes everything in and then throws it back out in a form that is very poetic linguistically, very attractive and persuasive, but not necessarily true, she said. Much further on the tech end, companies working to ground advanced AI, even super intelligent AI, a hypothetical system that would advance past human intelligence, in Buddhist practice and principles, is likely the most provocative domain the Buddhism and AI Institute has tracked. The buzziest example is SoftMax, a startup co-founded by former Twitch CEO Emmett Shear that's focused on organic alignment and AI agents discovering their values, even as those agents meet and aim to surpass human intelligence. Everything we know of reality is frame-dependent, Shear wrote in an April blog post, citing the Buddhist concept of sunyata, or the lack of inherent existence. At SoftMax, we strive to recognize the frame dependence of the agents we build. Another organization in the space is the Center for the Study of Apparent Selves, established with the goal of developing models of intelligence that are ethically and aesthetically fulfilling. The Nepal-based research institute includes experts in cognitive science, evolutionary biology, computer science, psychology, and religion. In addition to consulting at 84,000, the company name is 84000, Doctor is director and founder at CSAS. He sees overlap between the Buddhist goal of awakening and the pursuit of superintelligence. He notes the Bodhisattva vow, "For the sake of all sentient life, I shall achieve awakening," is inherently outward focused. Similarly, Doctor and his CSAS colleagues propose that care should be considered the driver of intelligence. If AI were trained on its own Bodhisattva vow, it could provide a framework for thinking of superintelligence, Doctor said. It's intrinsically an altruistic pursuit, and at the same time, it's something you take very seriously. Scammell, for his part, is unsure that building an enlightening ASI is the way we're going to build a better future, he said. I'm more motivated by strategies that help a lot of people understand the problem and contribute personally. And while he said he is heartened by how the initiative is bringing together Buddhists with wide-ranging projects and views, the hard work is yet to come. Buddhists are practiced at coming together, but many are less familiar with engaging policy professionals in shaping a better future, he said. For Buddhism to have a very meaningful impact on the field of AI, there's going to be a lot of stepping out of comfort zones that's needed. Meanwhile, she acknowledged, "We don't have a central body like the Vatican that speaks on behalf of all Buddhists, and she doesn't necessarily see the need for them to have one defining document on AI, at least not immediately. We in Buddhism really believe in the pause," she said. "Sometimes we have to stand in the eye of that tornado, watch what's happening, and not be swept into it." Our next story. The ideology that killed Rabin is alive and well 30 years later. This was written by Jeffrey Salkin, Religion News Service. It has been 30 years on November 4th since the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, and the echo of the gunshot still reverberates through Israel's public square and the Jewish soul. On that night in Tel Aviv, bullets did not only pierce his bodies, they shattered Israel's sense of itself. They tore through the fragile fabric of a nation trying to hold together its identity as both Jewish and democratic, both secure and compassionate. In the days after Rabin's murder, someone scrawled graffiti at what would come to be called Rabin Square. The words, translated into English, read, "Murdered by a man who wore a kippah." Like many Jewish texts, it is possible to read it in several different ways. The first possibility is that it was a taunt. "See what those observant Jews will do." Or maybe it was a lament. "Oh, see what observant Jews can do. How have we fallen so far?" I opted for the second. A cry of grief, mixed with disbelief that such hatred could emerge from within the folds of our own tradition, that it would come from a hand attached to a head that wore a simple symbol of reverence, humility, and identity. That moment still haunts me because it tells us that Rabin wasn't just murdered by Yigal Amir, the right-wing extremist who was convicted and sentenced to life in prison plus 14 years. Rabin was killed by a conspiracy of ideas, that faith tolerates no doubts or nuances and gives license to hatred, that God demands vengeance, that righteousness belongs to those who scream the loudest and compromise the least. Those ideas did not die with Amir. They have grown, mutated, and metastasized. They wear suits and sit in the Israeli cabinet. Bezalel Smotrich, Israel's finance minister, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, national security minister, are the heirs of the worldview that killed Rabin, the belief that Israel has no space for those who would compromise. Their far-right ideology is the grotesque byproduct of the same theology that led Amir to believe that shooting the prime minister was a mitzvah. They turned faith into a blunt instrument, and nationality into idolatry. What we see now is the normalization of what once lived on the margins, the sanctification of rage and worship of raw power. Rabin represented the opposite of that sickness. He was a soldier who became a peacemaker because he had seen the price of war. Recall the image of him at the White House lawn in 1993 when Yasser Arafat, then Palestinian Liberation Organization chairman, extended his hand. Rabin hesitated. He knew that the hand reaching toward him was stained with the blood of Jews. Yet he reciprocated. He knew that peace cannot exist without risk, and that leadership sometimes means crossing a line that was once forbidden. That trembling handshake was a declaration that Israel could defend itself without losing its soul. And for that, a Jew who believed that God preferred bullets to bridges murdered him. At Rabin's funeral, President Bill Clinton said, "Shalom, Haver," meaning farewell, friend. But shalom was the essence of Rabin's cause, as it also translates to peace. It became his life's mission and ultimately the reason for his death. We can only wonder what Rabin would think of the current Israel-Hamas peace plan. He likely would have applauded the impulse, the risk, to move the conversation forward, looking toward a horizon where Israelis and Palestinians might finally live without fear. But he also understood that true peace is not only about borders on a map of land and people, but about the borders between human hearts and spirits. I believe he would have wanted a peace that was not about managing conflict, but transforming a relationship. Israelis and Palestinians both learning to see each other as human. At a memorial concert for Rabin, Israeli musician Shlomo Artzi sang "Ha Ish Ha Hu," that man. The chorus is poignant. Where else are there people like that man? 30 years later, we still ask that question. Since the day he died, Israel has not raised up a prime minister quite like him. But the same poisonous mixture of religion, nationalism, and fear that inspired his killing now animates government policy. The messianic right-wing movement has made racism a virtue and hatred a badge of honor. They seem to dream of the Israel of Amir's fevered imagination. For the sake of Rabin's memory, Israel, the Jewish people, and the world, that cannot happen. His murder still matters because democracy depends on courage, and peace is the ultimate expression of strength. However, religion that worships land can easily become idolatry. The meaning of Rabin's death reaches beyond the borders of the Jewish state. It asks every society, what happens when our sacred symbols become excuses for cruelty? What happens when faith becomes fanaticism? When patriotism becomes purity? When the religious forget how to doubt themselves? Rabin's hesitation before that handshake is the model of moral seriousness the world so desperately lacks. He did not romanticize peace. He understood it would come with the same kind of hesitations that momentarily paralyzed his hand. His courage lay in knowing the danger and pressing forward anyway. The graffiti at Rabin Square, murdered by a man who wore a kippah, remains both accusation and elegy. It reminds us what happens when those who worship power hijack religious language and wear the garb that accompanies it. And it invites us still to reclaim the vision that hatred stole that night. Clinton's Shalom Haver was not only a goodbye, it was a charge to all of us to continue the work for which Rabin lived and died, the sacred, stubborn work of peace. If a man can be murdered for shaking a hand, then we must shake hands all the more. Peace is the dream that got him killed, but hope for it must persist. Our third story. 4 years after promising $10 million for racial reparations, Virginia's Episcopalians have little to show. Written by Aleha Herzler McCain. At the height of the anti-racism protests following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, the idea of reparations for black Americans for the long shadow of slavery gained traction. State and city leaders, as well as religious leaders, began to consider how to compensate those whose unpaid work had made them what they are today. In Virginia, the Episcopal Church's history of slavery made this quest especially significant. "I mean, it's the state of the Confederacy," said the Reverend Kelly Brown Douglas, a Harvard Divinity School professor who served on the neighboring Episcopal Diocese of Washington's Reparations Committee. If there is a diocese that could actually model and lead the way in this regard, it would be a diocese like that of Virginia. In 1860, some 82% of Episcopal clergy enslaved at least one other person in Virginia, according to the U.S. Census. In 2021, the Virginia Diocesan Convention, the diocese governing body, voted to appoint a racial reparations task force and raise $10 million toward a reparations endowment. The resolution did not specify what form those reparations would take, but it said it should be determined by and made to people directly affected by chattel slavery and violence against indigenous people. But nearly 4 years later, the Virginia Church's reparations effort has stalled, with no evidence that any of the $10 million has been raised. In March, Bishop Mark Stevenson abruptly dismissed the task force in a Zoom call, former members told Religion News Service, and the diocese has quietly missed goals once trumpeted as social justice wins. Even as corporations have recently backed away from diversity, equity, and inclusion pledges, Episcopal Church leaders continue to embrace racial justice, even in its most controversial form of reparations. But the experience of Virginia, the denomination's largest domestic diocese, shows that overcoming the practical challenges of reparations work, securing funds, agreeing on goals, and unifying the diocese behind a plan require more than a commitment to righting the wrongs of the past. Though the Virginia Diocese named a second task force with mostly new members, those who were dismissed are asking when and how the diocese will complete the resolution's mandate, and some said they believe fading interest in racial justice work has contributed to the diocese's struggle to deliver on its promise. The idea for a diocesan racial reparations fund began in 2020 through a group called Good Trouble, named after the late John Lewis's description of his civil rights work, said Dennis Carter Chand, a member of the group. In November of 2021, the group, led by the Reverend Case Ramey, offered a resolution to the Diocesan Convention calling for the $10 million endowment. It recommended the funds be raised through the sale of diocesan properties valued at $19 million. Bishop Susan Goff appointed a 12-member task force in April of 2022. Similar efforts were underway elsewhere in the Episcopal Church. Then-presiding Bishop Michael Curry, the first African-American to lead the denomination, had overseen the creation of a coalition for racial equality and justice and launched an 11-part anti-racist curriculum. New York, Texas, and Maryland dioceses also launched racial justice committees and reparations commissions. Carter Chand, who has read deeply about the history of slavery in Virginia, eagerly applied when the diocese announced the initiative, he said, highlighting his involvement with his local church. But he also offered his experience as a person of color in predominantly white churches, which he believed would help Episcopalians reckon with their racist history. We really wanted to engage the Episcopalians in Northern Virginia in a conversation about where we are now, why we are doing reparations, and what the history is, Carter Chan said. The idea felt like a spiritual moment, said another former task member who frequently requested anonymity because of the relationships in the diocese. It has started imperfectly. It was started with hope. Early on, the task force discussed ideas such as how to educate parishioners about how the diocese benefited economically from slavery, Carter Chan said. Their charge document called for its members to visit every region of the Diocese of Virginia and identify committees affected by the biases born out of white supremacy and systemic racism, including substandard housing, food deserts, subpar education, lack of fair wage employment, and lack of health care access. Under the leadership of Reverend James Blair, a missionary from England, the church used slaves to compensate priests, administer schools and orphanages, and grow its tobacco business, Oost explained. He had these ideas about how enslaved labor could build up the church, which was struggling in late 17th century Virginia, mainly because they could not get educated ministers to come over to the colonies. At William and Mary College in Williamsburg, Virginia, which Blair founded in 1693 to train ministers, slaves cultivated tobacco on college-owned lots. The profits funded scholarships for seminary students. Church officials also encouraged parishes to purchase slaves to work on lands, farmlands, at the disposal of priests, and to include the profits in their compensation, Oost said. That history was important, according to the task force, but the planned listening sessions in communities affected by the diocese's history of white supremacy never took place. A few discouraged members left as a result. Other members said they were dismayed by the diocese's lack of progress on raising the $10 million endowment, which contributed to the belief that the group was not fulfilling its mission. Stevenson declined to be interviewed, but wrote in an email that reparations work is rooted in the Episcopal Church's baptismal covenant. It isn't only about money, but also the systemic unmasking of insidious practices that perpetuate inequality and injustice. In the month leading up to the final meeting of the original task force, the Virginia Initiative already seemed to have hit a wall. I felt like we were kind of misled as a task force in the level of engagement, Carter Chan said of the diocese effort. Speaking at a worship service in November of 2024, Stevenson said the group had become too focused on money, according to several members. The first task force laid a strong and vital foundation, but added that the diocesan leadership recognized the need to reform and refresh the task force to focus on the next crucial phase of our work. The same day as the original task force was dismissed, a call was put out to restart the initiative with a new committee. This didn't feel routine at all. It felt rather abrupt, said a member of the original task force. I'm hoping I'm wrong, but it feels like slowing down the process rather than refreshing it. Asked why the initial task force was dismissed, the canon for racial justice and healing, said, refreshing committees and task force happen regularly. Some former task force members haven't given up hope. One said, my lament is that we weren't able to move with the fierceness that the spirit moment deserved. My hope is that the group is going to be able to build something beautiful. That last article was edited a bit for time because we have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a